Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
And welcome to the show. On this Tuesday, April 21st, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg.
Is AI going to take my job? Is AI going to take your job,
Kevin?
I
don't think so, Avi. Not you.
How about you?
We'll see.
Yeah, right? You tell me you've never been up late at night thinking about this question.
Yeah. Well, especially for my kids and the next generation.
Absolutely. So today on the show, we're going to ask that question in a couple different ways. We're going to ask, first of all, is AI taking jobs right now? Then we're going to ask, is AI going to take jobs or augment jobs significantly, let's say in the near to midterm future, 5, 10, 15 years, and which jobs are most at risk? And then thirdly, we're going to ask, what is going to be the political and cultural disruption caused by all of this displacement, if indeed it happens? Because if you look at something like the Industrial Revolution, which some people compare this moment to, it changed everything about where people live, the type of music and art we consume. I mean, our political movements. Is that going to happen with AI?
Everything could be blown up. Everything could be different.
Everything could be changing, right? And so we're going to talk to a couple of really great experts, and we would love to hear from you on this topic. How is AI impacting your job? What's working? What worries you? And I'll also ask this question. Do you buy this? Do you buy the idea that AI is going to lead to massive job displacement? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Kevin, you will not be displaced.
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. And things are moving so fast that, like, just a few years ago, ChatGPT is out, and now it's like we're on this rapid pace where we don't know exactly what's coming next. And even though we've done these AI shows numerous times over the past 2 years, the conversation keeps changing as things are changing. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation you have today, Avi. But
Absolutely.
First, a trio of local news stories. The Democratic race in the 3rd Congressional District is heating up as we're now less than a month away from primary day. Some nice reporting by city and state PA from a forum last night in West Philadelphia, where State Rep Chris Rabb, Dr. Ayla Stanford, and Sharif Street, State Senator Sharif Street, sparred over their views on the Israel-Hamas war and their track records of getting stuff done. Rabb is kind of riding a high right now, Avi, as the most recent campaign finance data showed he had raised more than double his opponents in the first 3 months of 2026. He also picked up the Inquirer's editorial board endorsement this week. He has the backing of the left flank of the party. He's got an interview coming up with influential left-wing podcaster Hassan Piker. Alice Stanford, though, does still have the most cash to spend in the race. She's been pounding the airwaves and the mailboxes with this message centered on her outsider status, her work during the pandemic to create the Black Doctors Consortium. It's State Senator Sharif Street, though, who has a key thing that the other two don't.
What is that?
That's the backing of the Democratic Party, the ward leaders, and the building trades unions, all of whom are pretty skilled at getting out the vote, especially in low turnout elections. And I'll note that that really was the recipe that got Sherelle Parker elected as mayor of Philadelphia.
Yeah. Sherelle Parker backing Sharif Street in this race. We also got a couple more endorsements today. I think Chrissy Houlihan and Madeline Dean, who are in Congress here in Pennsylvania, backing Ayla Stanford. It's fascinating to me the way this race is broken. It feels like there is a legitimate argument for all three of these candidates. I mean, like a legitimate race. One thing that I think Rabb has going for him, you mentioned his momentum, is that he seems to have distinguished himself as the progressive
right
in the race. And if you look back at a recent contested primary, the mayoral primary that Sherelle Parker won, there was a sense that Rebecca Reinhart and Helen Gim kind of split the progressive vote. Maybe not 50-50, but there was some split. It's looking more and more like Rabb has the possibility of consolidating. And if you look at this congressional district, I don't think it would be fair to say that progressive make up a majority of the voters. But if you can get all of them in your camp, then you've got the potential for a plurality. And so that seems to be the way Rabb is playing this, but still a long way to go, even though there's not that much time.
Yeah, and this is my district. I live in Northwest Philadelphia, so just even the litmus test of people I talk to, I've been hearing anecdotally people starting to know Chris Rabb's name who didn't know it before. That kind of struck me. But really, the party power and, you know, the things that they hand out on election day and their ability to get out the vote. State Senator Sharif Street has been considered the front runner. Mm-hmm. It's kind of his race to lose, and we will see in less than a month. But we also should mention, next week, Wednesday, on Studio 2, live at noon, we are hosting a debate for this primary.
Sounds like a great
idea. With those three great viable candidates. So really looking forward to that. And if you want to come to that event, it's happening right here at WHYY headquarters. We have space available, but you need to register at whyy.org/events.
This was just an elaborate way to plug that event. Wow. 5 minutes of wasted conversation plugging the event, whyy.org/events. Story number two, is Temple in trouble? Talking about the university in North Philadelphia. The Inquirer had some reporting this week on a new internal report from Temple that shows the university is really dealing with some enrollment and financial challenges. Enrollment down 27% over the last 8 years, and freshman to sophomore retention also down. Temple president John Fry says there's some painful decisions coming that need to be made with, quote, a sense of urgency. Already 50 Temple employees laid off last year. And this is not just a Temple problem. Enrollment is down significantly in the past decade at places like Drexel in the PA state school system. And more broadly, right, the number of high school graduates in America has peaked already. And those numbers are starting to decline. A recent study from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia found about 60 colleges closing on average each year with a rate that could go much higher.
Yeah, we've been talking about this enrollment cliff for higher ed.
Yeah.
And, you know, Temple is one of the colleges in our region that is having to figure that out. And they have John Fry, who was at Drexel before, and Drexel has faced its share of challenges as well. And it seems like this report that was, you know, kind of put out there and done internally is almost like greasing the wheels to start the conversation, yeah. Get people thinking stuff is going to have to change. We can't just stick to status quo.
Yeah, this might not be in an internal report that they didn't want anyone on the outside to see. But putting that aside, right. And one thing that you could see that they've already forecasted at Temple and we've seen other schools do is consolidation of closure of satellite campuses.
Right.
So Penn State already did a big round of that. Temple has a campus in Ambler. And I think there's an open question about these satellite campuses in an era where you maybe don't need a physical presence in a second or third or fourth location to attract students because of the connectivity of our modern world. And of course, real estate can bring in a lot of money if you find other uses for it. So that is something that I'm watching, not just with Temple, but all schools that have satellite campuses.
Yeah, and beyond the enrollment number conversation, there does seem to be some affordability stuff happening here.
If
you look nationally, the rate of college freshmen actually went up 1% in the past year, but it was really enrollment at community colleges driving that and a downward trajectory for private four-year institutions. So clearly, I think you can read into that the affordability crisis we've been talking about is impacting people's decisions when it comes to higher ed as well.
Absolutely. Story number three, Kevin, this is an interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely crazy finish in a marathon run over the weekend in Wilmington, Delaware. That's now making international news. Okay, so 24-year-old Carson Mello, he's from Western Pennsylvania. He looked to be cruising to victory at a brisk 6:14 mile pace. When all of a sudden, here comes 24-year-old Pottstown native Joshua Jackson absolutely booking it down the final stretch to the finish line. You can hear the excitement from one fan in this now viral clip as Jackson took the victory.
Oh my God. He came from so far behind.
Yes.
That was insane.
So the voice you hear there is Instagram user Activate Ed Leem. Shout out to him for taking the video. Now, Mello is being criticized a little bit for maybe pulling up too early, thinking he had the W in the bag.
He was raising his arms
right
above his head a little bit.
Got that thing going. Now, you can't tell exactly what's going on in his head based on the video, sure. Avi, I will say, right? Like, the body does funky things when you're crossing that 26-mile
You're
threshold.
A marathoner, so you know this.
I just happened to finish a marathon pretty recently, and I'll say I was planning to really kick at the end, and I just did not have it in my body.
Nice humble brag, by the way. Go ahead.
But I think the real takeaway for me is Joshua Jackson had it in the bag because his take down that finish line, down that stretch, was just so incredible. I've never seen someone run that fast the final 200 yards of a marathon. I'm sure it's out there, but this was just so impressive to see. So I know some people are giving Mello shade. I'm going to say the man still ran a 240-something marathon,
sure,
and he came 2 seconds away from winning, but you got to give it up to Joshua Jackson for laying it all out there and having it in the tank at the end.
Shout out to Joshua Jackson. Call him Pacey because he is setting a quick pace. Dawson's Creek reference. Yeah, I do like there's plenty of sports stories with premature celebrations, but at least this one has also a hero, someone who overcame adversity as well. The worst ones are when someone messes up and it's not because their opponent did anything spectacular, just because they messed up. And those videos do exist as well. So at least in this video, there is a heartwarming element to go along with the heart-wrenching element.
Absolutely.
Speaking of heart-wrenching, is AI going to cause a lot of heartache for people in the workforce? We're going to unpack that question on the other side of this break. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Greggs Hadley is off this week. You've probably heard the apocalyptic forecasts about AI's effect on jobs. Maybe you're even feeling it at work. But the question of just how much artificial intelligence will upend human labor and who will bear the brunt is very much a debate. Now, some CEOs have sounded the alarm. Verizon's Dan Schulman recently predicted 20-30% unemployment in the next 2 to 5 years. However, other experts advise more caution. While there's consensus that some disruption lies ahead, the scale and timeline still very much uncertain. So today we're looking at possible futures with AI at work. Will it push people out of their jobs? What lessons can we learn from earlier periods of technological upheaval, from the Industrial Revolution to the internet age? And we'll also talk about how these changes could ripple through our politics, culture, and wider society. With us to do all of that, it's an easy task, right? We've got Martha Gimbel, the executive director and co-founder of the Budget Lab at Yale. Martha, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And just to my right is Ethan Mollick, author of Co-Intelligence and associate professor and co-director of Generative AI Labs at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Ethan, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you as well.
And as always, we would love to hear from you out there. I really feel like this is a great participation show. How is AI impacting your job? What's working? Are you worried about being replaced? And do you buy this hype that AI is going to displace lots of workers in our economy? Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Before we get to the future, I think we have to address the present. Is AI leading to significant, measurable job loss right now? Martha, your answer to that question is
no.
No. Okay, so if not, why not?
I can expand, but you know, so I'll say a couple things here. You know, a bunch of us have been looking at this, and there are some people who have found some very concentrated effects for very specific workers. I should say, if you've heard about those, you know, economists are still debating how real those effects are, whether or not it may reflect other things that are happening in the economy at the same time. But if you look at the economy as a whole, there is really no evidence of broad AI disruption at this time. And so I think the rhetoric has really outpaced the reality of where we are.
So why aren't we seeing significant disruptions. And I, of course, it's only been a few years since most of us got access to things like ChatGPT, but a few years is a few years. And a lot of people are investing a lot of money in this technology. So Martha, why do you think we haven't seen the dent yet in the labor market?
So it's a couple of things. I mean, one, you say it's a few years, but it takes businesses and workers time to figure out how to use a new technology. And AI is what's referred to as a general purpose technology, by which people mean it's not the technology itself, it's what people do with it. You know, I always like to joke, electricity changed nothing. What people did with electricity changed everything. And so it's not like you can just pick it up and implement it in your business tomorrow. You have to figure out how to use it. The other aspect of this is, you know, we talk about, you know, ChatGPT came out in November 2022. And when we have these conversations, it's often as if the technology looked the same back then as it does today. There's been huge changes. And so, you know, the capability of what the technology could do a couple of years ago is very, very different than what it could do now. And so I think people just need to realize it's going to take some time.
I guess one of my big questions, and we talk about take some time, will the pace be similar to the pace of change we saw in past technological transitions, revolutions, upheavals, whatever word you want to use, Ethan? Because one thing you do hear out there is that we're in some sort of era where the pace of change is accelerating. So whatever transition we went through in the 1800s with the Industrial Revolution, this is going to be faster than that. Do you buy that argument with AI?
So a few things. First of all, I completely agree that we haven't seen big effects yet, right? And you could go to any company, anyone who's out there who works at an organization, I could guarantee you nothing major changed in any large company in 2025. That doesn't necessarily mean it's true in 2026 or 2027. And there are some things that are different. First of all, like our number of industrial revolutions we have is pretty small, like maybe three.
Yeah.
So like, and they were very different technologies. So we're trying to extrapolate from a fairly small sample. What makes AI a little bit different is, on one hand, we absolutely need that adaption and tooling and, you know, how do you change a process around AI? What do we do differently? What should workers do with their time? And the technology is getting better more rapidly. But it also is sort of a self-implementing technology to some degree, because it kind of works like a person. You can assign AI to do a task. It does that task. That makes it easier to, you know, to implement in some ways than electricity or something that required retooling an entire factory. So we don't really have an answer. I think that there's a general expectation among the economists that I talk to that things will happen faster with this technology than other ones. But I think
like
that the
vis-a-vis electricity.
Yeah, right. I mean, electricity wasn't even that long. I mean, you know, 10 to 30 years. I think people are thinking we will start to see some fairly substantial changes in, you know, in the next 5 or 6 years inside some companies. Then the other thing is, as was previously mentioned also, the technology is improving. The goal of the AI labs is to make a technology that is a drop-in replacement for all humans everywhere. I don't think they're going to get there soon, but that is their explicit goal.
Right.
And so there is this sort of countervailing factor. So I completely agree, no major change yet. I think there's a lot of questions, though, about how quickly the rest of the change is going to start happening.
Do you see more friction in the pace of change, Martha, than what Ethan laid out? Because I think there's a little tension here between, is this like a past technological change in terms of its speed, or is this somehow different? I'd love to hear your approach to that same question.
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is almost certainly going to be faster. I do not think it's going to be as fast as many people in Silicon Valley think that it's going to be. You know,
because they have an incentive to project that it's going to be faster, or just because they're techno optimists and they're delusional.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually am really glad you asked this question, because I think sometimes, you know, you have these statements coming out of the labs and people go like, oh, well, they're just paid to hype this. Like, this is their book. Like, no, these are people who like really believe in AI and have believed in AI for a very long time. And so I don't think people should be saying to themselves like, oh, this is just a PR statement. I do think one, you know, many people are technologists, they're not economists, or, you know, don't focus on industrial organization. And so they're not thinking about like, how will we, you know, fit this in with the IT and legal department, which is a real concern for companies. I think it is also the case, right, that in some ways, the nature of the work that Silicon Valley does and the way that the economy works in Silicon Valley is different than many other places. Mm. And so, for instance, there are more people in Silicon Valley whose job is to sit in a chair and write code all day. You know, like they're not interacting with other humans. They don't have to figure out how to build that into a broader work stream. I don't want to oversimplify this,
right?
Coders are going to be calling in and be like, no, I do this all the time. But it, you know, relative to, say, a nurse, it's a very different work stream.
Sure.
And so I think how work works in Silicon Valley has given people a different perspective on how fast this can happen.
And Martha mentioned callers, by the way. We'd love to hear from you. How do you feel AI is changing your work right now? What's working? What worries you? And do you buy this idea that there's going to be a significant workforce disruption caused by AI? I want to read this fascinating email from Matthew, who says, I'm writing from Hollow House Farms in Bucks County, where AI has become a practical tool in everyday farming. We use it to track germination rates, identify weeds and invasive species early, and make faster, more informed crop decisions. What used to take hours now takes minutes. It's not replacing the farmer, it's strengthening the farmer. The work is still hands-on, but the decisions are sharper. For small farms like ours, that makes a real difference. That's a fascinating email from Matthew, and I'm curious what you make of it, Ethan, because we're going to get to displacement in a second. We're going to talk about jobs that could go away. But let's talk about jobs where you think AI is going to be incorporated, but the number of humans doing the jobs could remain about the same. Can you give us a sense of what that class of jobs is?
Sure. And I also think it's important to just the big picture, because I love that story. Yeah. And I've agreed with everything Martha's been saying so far. Sorry, no clash on that, but we're in agreement on
we'll
all
get
that.
To a clash. I'm sure we'll find one.
But I think that a few things. One is, you know, it's not inevitable that jobs are destroyed, right? Like what you're hearing is an example of augmentation rather than automation there, right? So you have the farmer doing more than they could before, probably skipping stuff they didn't like to do, getting better advice than they could because they'd have to call all these experts. You could only call like the Ag Extension School so many times to get information, right? And so there's a lot of augmentation. That doesn't mean it can't be the same thing for jobs that are squarely in the crosshairs of AI, like coding. Maybe we need to have more coders, right? Maybe the coders could have their job is a different kind of approach. So I don't think it's inevitable to say there's categories of jobs that are destroyed. I think transformed is the right way to view this, right?
But
and the choices come down to who, you know, to the leadership inside these organizations and what they imagine these jobs can do. It's we make the technology too much the determinant of the outcome rather than the people and organizations, government, everybody else who has a say in this. And also how we shape it. I love that this person, keep in mind, ChatGPT was not built to identify weeds, right? Or, you know, there's another great paper showing it identifies pig diseases really well. Nobody knew it would do those things. You tell the Silicon Valley people that, they're surprised. But the fact that it's a general purpose technology, to go back to, you know, the phrasing before, means there's many ways to use this that aren't always destructive.
Right. And by the way, Leave Balone on YouTube says, I worry about the AI cognitive surrender concept. If we turn over our thinking to these LLMs, we erode our own ability to use our brains, use it or lose it. And that's sort of, it's a slightly different point than what you're making, Ethan, but it is this idea that we do control our destiny on some level. And Martha, you were trying to jump in there when Ethan was responding to that comment about the farmer. I'm curious for your thoughts.
Yeah, I just wanted to build on this a little bit. So I think so often the conversation about what's going to happen with jobs is very binary.
Yeah.
This will be like destroyed by AI. This will not be destroyed by AI. The technology can do the job. It cannot do the job. Full stop, done. And the thing is, we know that there are a lot of factors that impact how technology is rolled out, not just, you know, decisions in organizations or, you know, what we decide to do with it, but also things like how old the population is. Older populations tend to use technology for more automation for understandable reasons, right? Less in labor force. How consumer demand responds. If you can be more productive and produce something at a lower price, but actually people want more and more of what you're producing, employment in that sector may actually go up because now people can buy more of it at a lower price.
So like if the farmer is more efficient and can produce more crops, the price per bushel goes down. All of a sudden the market for this gets bigger. Is that the kind of idea we're running along with here?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, food is not the best example,
sure.
Only because like there's only so much
you can eat.
You can eat.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, there are things that we can't afford right now, many of us, because they're really expensive. I mean, anyone who's had to deal with family law, if you're trying to make a will or you're trying to get a divorce, it's really expensive.
Yeah.
We know there are people who would actually hire more lawyers if it were cheaper. AI may be about to make lawyers much cheaper. Does that mean every lawyer is going to lose their job? Not necessarily. It partly depends on how consumer demand responds. Mm. And so I really want to encourage people to think about this, you know, not just in a, can AI literally do this task that I do way, but also in it, like, what is the broader context of my job? What is the people value about my job? And how would the market respond to a change in the price for what I do?
Right. It's not so clear cut. However, we've got a gloomier message here from someone named Robert. Okay, so let's read this one out. I've worked in customer service for 15 years. My company adopted AI a year ago, and now AI is doing about 60% of my job. I personally have seen 4 people in my company lose their jobs directly because of it. I honestly do not see that my job as it is right now will be viable a year from now. Entry-level jobs where I started are pretty much gone. What I have done in the past year, though, is learn everything I could possibly learn about AI. I have embedded myself in AI implementation and absorption within my company, as it's the only way that I can make myself valuable in my job as it is. Worst comes to worst, I'll get another job. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there in that message from Robert. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. So I'm going to read. Look, there's a lot of statistics out there. This is one from the Boston Consulting Group, recent report. They estimate that about 12% of current jobs are what they call substituted roles, which are jobs where there could be, what I took from the report, there could be some one-to-one replacement. That's still a pretty big number, Ethan. We're hearing there from someone who's in customer service. Can you give us an idea of what types of jobs are at least at risk for this one-to-one replacement, where there isn't maybe not going to be an expanding demand created by the replacement of the job?
So I'm going to end up sounding like I'm dodging this, which feels really annoying, and I'm not trying to do that. It's just there's a lot of conditionals there, right? Like, I think customer service has been an area always under threat, right? Yep. Cost centers and companies, they love to cut. I've talked to companies who view customer service now as they're using AI augmented. So the customer service agents have more time with the very high value customers, and lower value customers speak to an AI tool. I mean, there is not an inevitable way that this works out one way or another, right? Depending on how adoption works, depending on what they're using in these systems. But at the same time, there is obviously going to be job loss, right? We like, where that shifts in demand about where the jobs are, where that some companies having trouble sustaining their competitive advantage in the world of AI, whether it's job categories being changed. I think one thing is, we're talking about jobs as a whole, and we don't tend to think about jobs as a whole when we look at jobs. We tend to think of jobs as bundles of tasks, mm-hmm. right? So in the way a lot of economists have tended to measure what jobs are at risk from AI is what's called exposure, right? How much of your job is exposed to AI.
Right.
And they look at how many tasks are exposed. And I think about this a lot because business school professor is 22 on the list of 1,016 most exposed jobs.
Oh, gosh.
Right? And in theory, that's true, right? But the other thing is, we one of our very first papers, ironically, at Boston Consulting Group, we analyzed Boston Consulting Group, we identified that AI is what we call a jagged frontier. It's good at some stuff and bad at some stuff. So it turns out that any job, there's some tasks that AI might be really good at, but there's some that it's really bad at, right?
It's never 100%.
I won't say it's never 100%.
Very close to never, yeah.
But most jobs are more complicated than you think, right? You have to do research before this. You have to come up with the questions. You have to actually shoot the show. You have to fill out some forms from NPR. You have to go to fundraisers. There's 1,000 things you're doing, plotting the next show. Some of those things might be taken by AI. There's a chance that the other tasks bottleneck what we have to do so much that they actually become more valuable, even as some of your tasks become less valuable. Right. That does not understate the idea that there's going to be replacement. I mean, that's where government policy matters. Yep. That's where choices that we make matter. But I do think that it's too easy a model to say it swaps in for your job in its entirety.
Yeah. I want to read, we have a caller, actually. This is Akram from Philly online, too. Akram's one of our regulars, always a good caller, so I'm very interested to hear what Akram's going to add to the conversation. Hey, Akram, you're back on Studio 2. What's your question or comment or perspective?
Thank you. Thanks, team. I love the discussion. Just calling to share my own experience as a software engineer, because I was laid off last July, and I was lucky to find a job fairly quickly by September, but the delta in growth in AI and the capability of the model since then makes me wonder, if I were to lose my job today, how fast I would be able to find a new one. I worry a lot about recent college graduates entering into software engineering. I think they're going to have a really hard time. I don't know what the numbers, but it really scares me. My second quick point is how we as software engineers use AI. There's all kinds of software engineers, but how I use it specifically, I generate a lot more code now than I ever could before, but I also spend a lot more time reading it and reviewing it. So I think I'm not worried about particularly becoming obsolete, but the way we teach software engineering is going to have to shift to match the moment. My third and final comment is back to the speed at which this is growing. It's very concerning to me. We're going to see a lot of companies that come up that solve problems. I think this is the wider pitch, but yeah. The fragility of those products will worry me to see if they're actually built well and sustainable in the long term.
Oh,
thank
great
you.
Call. Thank you, Akram. So there's a lot to unpack there. But Martha, I would love to hear your response to that call, because there's a couple things going on with what Akram says. One is, look, you could say lost his job and then he found another job. Good story. But there's still displacement. There's still transition there. Yeah. And that's still a pain point. And then just obviously Akram's worried about the scale, which this is all changing, whether there are guardrails. So pick any part of that you'd like to react to. I'm just curious what you make of Akram's story.
Yeah, I mean, I do get frustrated sometimes when economists, including me, talk about this and we say, you know, like every technological revolution, at the end of it, there's been new jobs. It's impossible for us to imagine what those will be like. You know, I often point out that if my ancestors knew what my job was, they would roll their eyes and go, that's not a job. Thank you for your time. And certainly probably to other people on this show. But transitions are terrible. Transitions are really, really hard. And, you know, the one that Akram was just talking about, I'm sure was very painful, but also in the realm of transitions wasn't even a particularly stressful one, right? You know, we define long-term unemployment as being over 6 months. He didn't hit that. I'm not trying to minimize what he went through. I'm just saying, you know, that it's even
there's going to be even worse. Yeah. Exactly. Examples of that. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, if you look at past industrial revolutions, you know, and what happened to the weavers, people who were weavers at the beginning of the first industrial revolution did not recover.
Yep.
It was horrible for them. And so, you know, I worry a little bit, or I worry a lot rather about, I think the conversation focuses too much on where are we going to end up rather than how can we make the transition as painless for people as possible. You know, I think we saw in COVID how well our unemployment insurance system functions, not particularly well. And so I really, really worry that we are not set up for a transition of any size.
Yeah.
I want to dig in just to nerd out for just a brief second.
Oh, nerd out. Go ahead.
Let's nerd out. Let's go. So, you know, he was asking, about, you know, talking about software engineers and in technology. And there's this sort of weird fact that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which does government data on the labor market, doesn't have like specifically a tech sector. And so economists have to kind of pull together what that looks like.
Yep.
And depending on how you're defining tech, it's either losing jobs, been losing jobs for a while, probably in a way that's not entirely related to AI, but maybe like in other data, postings for software engineers are increasing. So maybe there's some of, you know, what we talked about before of consumer demand is going up. And I actually do want to emphasize to people that our data around this is not perfect.
Yeah.
And our ability to really have a perfect handle on what is happening in specific occupations and specific sectors is not great. And so, you know, we're doing our best here, but it is really hard to figure out, particularly in real time.
I want to read this comment before we get to a break from Hibbard, who says, I lost my job as an e-com photographer when Loft Ann Taylor and many other brands switched to a program called Looklit. They do a 3D scan of young models, then use AI post-production. The company ran an A-B test in the Midwest to see what shoppers liked. The shoppers always picked the real models over the robots. And so we have talked a lot about like coders because, like you said, Ethan, a lot of what they do can be done by AI. But one thing that you've brought up in the past, Martha, is this idea that it might not be the amount of your job that can be done by AI, but if you are just in an industry that faces a lot of financial headwinds and pressures where there's a lot of pressure to cut costs, even if your job can't be done that well by AI, they still might ax you. As we go to a break, I just would love to hear you, Martha, expand on that point a little bit. Like that's where the pain, those could be the weavers more than the coders in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we know is that in recessions, automation goes up because companies are trying to cut costs. And you can have small versions of that, right, in particular industries or sectors. And so, you know, there's been a lot of focus on tech with AI. I'm particularly worried about media and the arts. You know, if you think about, for instance, Hollywood, there's a lot of technological capability there right now. It's also an industry that's been in recession for quite some time.
Right.
There's a lot of economic pressure there. And there aren't like liability or regulatory concerns that are going to hold them back. If you're a hospital, you may be concerned about replacing an anesthesiologist with AI because if something goes wrong, you're going to get sued. If Ariana Grande has six fingers on the cover of Vogue, no one's going to sue you.
Exactly. And so like the cost benefit analysis is different and the cost pressure on those industries is really, really high. So we're going to talk more about that on the other side of this break. We have a caller waiting, some great comments lined up. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY, where we are asking the question this hour. Are you seeing, you know, AI impacting your job? What's working? What's not? Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off for the week. We've been talking about AI upheavals in the workplace and the predictions of what could be coming. We're also taking some lessons from past tech revolutions about how to weather the coming storm. Let me reintroduce our two guests. Martha Gimble is executive director and co-founder of the Budget Lab at Yale. Ethan Mollick is author of Co-Intelligence and associate professor and co-director of generative AI labs at the Wharton School and the University of Pennsylvania. We've been asking you this hour, how is AI impacting your job? What's working? What worries you? And do you buy this idea that there's going to be a big disruption in the labor market because of AI? The number is 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org. Let's bring in Josh from Aston on the line. Hey, Josh, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Hey, so I'm a librarian, and the thought process in information sciences is that there should be a defining difference between operant AI and generative AI, where operant is something like a closed system, so like a library catalog. If you can teach the algorithm to only look at your collection, it can give you the information you want, and it works in reference. But if you're asking a generative model, they can pull from anywhere. So how do you know, or how do you cite those sources, right? And that's what a librarian would do, is to look at referencing and being like, okay, well, this is a proper source. Mm. But I think operant AI works well for cataloging, or, you know, even medical within a closed system based on, let's say, like a medical resource that is vetted. So I think that's an important differential that we need to make here.
Thanks, Josh. Curious for your thoughts on that, Ethan. This gets to a question we've talked about earlier, which is implementation of technology, not just sort of like the technology exists. What did you make of that call?
So actually, it's a really good call, because I think AI means many things, yep. Right? So I kind of divide AI and jobs into sort of three zones, although AI has been around since the 1950s as a term. So you could talk about prior to ChatGPT. For most people, we said AI, and there were lots of conversations around tables like this one about AI. We were talking about what he called operant AI, but we could call machine learning. If I have enough data, I can have data scientists go through that data, build specific algorithms, and that will like make me prediction. Let me make predictions. So I can figure out what price I should charge you, what movies to recommend you if I'm Netflix, where in the card catalog to look or whatever. And that was a very sort of constrained sort of approach. Mm-hmm. Then we moved on to sort of ChatGPT was launched, and we had this era that I will boldly call co-intelligence, because that's the title of my book, but you can call it anything you want, but where you'd work with a chatbot. And that's where a lot of people are today. Like, I want to get advice, I ask a chatbot a question, I get an answer back. That's one form of generative AI. In the last few months, and this is where the sort of coders are the canary in the coal mine, we moved towards a world of what we call agentic AI, where rather than going back and forth with the system, you can assign it a task, and it can do 8, 9, 10-hour tasks on its own with reasonable chances of success without a human intervening at all, yeah. Right? So part of what we're talking about is what form, like, and that agentic AI combines some of the advantages of that earlier AI form too. So you're probably used to in chatbots, earlier chatbots would make all kinds of mistakes if you ask for a citation. That doesn't happen as much anymore with the most advanced AI models. They tend to be accurate in citing information. They tend to be very good at research. So a lot of our capabilities that we think of about what AI can do and can't do are changing very, very rapidly, right?
let me go back to something that Martha brought up earlier, the weavers in the Industrial Revolution. And this has sort of become like a symbolic group to stand in for the people most directly harmed by a technological change. These are people directly replaced by machines, and then the jobs that they could get were simply lower wage, less healthy, more grueling jobs. Let's not predict whether like who the weavers might be, but do you believe there is a group in society who will be the modern weavers when we talk about this change? Like that group exists somewhere.
There are going to be job subcategories or types that will probably disappear. Right. Yep. I mean, I don't think anyone would imagine that's not the case. Now, the question is always the analogy, right? After the ATM, there were more bank tellers, not less, because you had your bank tellers focus on high value clients. But then the iPhone came along and people didn't want to talk to bank tellers anymore.
Right.
Suddenly bank tellers dropped. Like technological revolutions have winners and losers in those jobs. And similarly, when you look at, you know, economic history, it depends on who you are. For example, something I don't remember the numbers, 9% or 13% of women at one point or another during the time this was active acted as telephone operators.
Yep.
When electronic telephone operating started happening, everyone lost their jobs. Younger women got better jobs. Some categories of older women got better jobs. Some people were left, you know, without ever finding as good a job again. So I think there is a lot of complexity in this process. But yes, I think there's, just as Martha was saying, I think we need systems to protect ourselves.
Right.
Industrial revolutions kind of suck to live through for a lot of people.
Yep.
The outcomes are great. But, and it's not just, by the way, there's contestations over who should be winners, who should be losers. These aren't decisions that are made just by technology. Government makes decisions on this. Industry makes decisions. Unions make decisions. There's a reason why this is a complicated process.
Absolutely. So talking about how to weather the storm and get through the transition, I want to read this comment from Lisa on YouTube. If AI takes away jobs, what happens to Social Security? Fewer workers, less money for Social Security and Medicare, and so many more programs. That's something that's on Lisa's mind. And let me bring in a caller, Rich from Bucks County, who I think is also going to talk about our political response to this moment. Rich, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thanks. Good segue, because my comment is politics has proven lousy at resolving this kind of issues. When you look at, you know, we want to eliminate coal for environmental reasons, but we've left whole regions of the United States with either poor employment or no employment. And, you know, what it does is it fosters a MAGA movement, because there's a bunch of angry people in the country because they can't make a living without moving. And I see AI as doing the same thing, but our politicians have already proven their inability to deal with this sort of thing.
Thank you, Rich.
So
interesting
how do we
insight.
Plan ahead to resolve it?
Great question. I'm going to kick that to Martha. How do we plan ahead to resolve it? You don't have to solve the whole thing right now, Martha, but...
But you should.
but I mean, like, look, this is a really, really important point, because as Rich points out, Rich is talking... Coal is one example, but deindustrialization... More broadly, the loss of manufacturing jobs, that did hollow out communities all over the country, and there were political, cultural, economic ramifications of that. Is there a path toward avoiding that, and what, broadly speaking, does that path look like?
I mean, I think one thing that was really hard about, you know, the deindustrialization, coal, you know, things that happened there, is that it happened slowly. And so it could kind of inch up over time and wasn't this crisis that forced policymakers to deal with it.
Yep.
I'm not saying like the solution is to have a tsunami of job loss and then the policymakers will have to deal with it. That's also a bad idea. But I think, you know, that is something to keep in mind, is that the pace and size of this will affect how much policymakers are incentivized to act. I hate to keep going back to the 19th century, but I'm going to.
Go ahead. I like the 19th century.
Let's
go ahead.
It. We're going to do it. You know, I think one reason that we focus on the weavers relative to other people who have been automated, like workers in factories, is because they were relatively high status workers. And so they were able to push back, right?
Yep.
And even then, they weren't particularly successful.
Can I stop you on that point? Because this is something I hear a lot in the predictions around AI, is that the people who will be harmed most by this job revolution are actually the higher status, more educated, white collar workers, and that the workers that were most harmed by deindustrialization, the blue collar workers, might actually benefit relative to this other group. And I want to play a clip. This went around recently. It's Alex Karp, Philadelphian, CEO of Palantir AI company, making some predictions about, it's on CNBC, by the way, making some predictions about what demographics of people might be most impacted by all this. Let's roll that clip.
This technology disrupts humanity's trained, largely Democratic voters and makes their economic power less and increases the power, economic power of vocationally trained, working class, often male voters. And so these disruptions are going to disrupt every aspect of our society.
All right, Martha, does he have a point there outside of his gratuitous use of the word disruption? I mean, is that actually a keen observation about who will be most impacted?
I realize people are sick of me and Ethan saying this, but maybe. I think where people are getting that from are those exposure measures that Ethan mentioned earlier. And if you just mechanically apply those measures, then yes, you get that more Democratic, more female, more highly educated workers are, quote unquote, more exposed to AI. I actually think this is a really important thing for people to take away. Exposure does not mean automation. The best way to think about exposure is predicted future usage, right? And so basically, exposure is predicting that there will be more usage of AI around a specific task, and then we, you know, aggregate that up to be about an occupation. Just because there's more use of AI in an occupation does not mean that it is going away. It doesn't mean that it's becoming lower paid. We have, you know, there are all of these other factors that come into play here. I actually, not to pick on Ethan, but, you know, he brought up ATMs earlier, and he said, you know, oh, when you had ATMs come in, it expanded bank tellers because, you know, they could do these higher value tasks. Actually, one of the things that was happening at the same time that ATMs were introduced was deregulation in the banking sector. And so you had this, at the same time, expansion of the banking sector in response to deregulation. And so how much of this was about higher value tasks versus this other economic force that was pushing in that direction? Sort of unclear.
Right.
But again, this comes back to just because you're exposed, it doesn't mean you're getting automated. And it doesn't mean that these other factors won't play a role as well. And so, again, it's just more complicated.
But let me, I guess, maybe then ask in sort of a different way, is that a possible future, right? Because, like, so I want to read something from David Autor, who's a professor at MIT, who makes this argument that actually we could see AI increase equality or decrease inequality because people who have less sort of formal education would have access to AI tools and could do tasks that maybe lawyers and doctors do. And someone here in the comments, Mount Airy Home Companion, says family doctors will become a last resort since everyone will diagnose themselves. That basically this could empower economically and just knowledge-wise people with less formal education and could reduce some level of inequality. Do you buy the idea that's a possible future, Ethan?
So, first of all, half a step back here.
Sure.
I feel like we are doing the same thing. We, you know, in some ways, there's a tendency among, there's sort of this growing economic consensus that I think both Martha and I have been talking about to some degree. But I also think it's a very sliced moment in time, right? Like right now, AI development remains exponentially gaining. It's still jagged, not good at everything. But like new stuff is coming out every week. The pace of change is very rapid. And to make lines about what AI can or can't do, right? The reason why a lot of work might be safe might be, okay, robotics is bad. Well, does robotics stay bad if large language models get very good at coding and you could do, and they start to be very good at doing robotics tasks? Like, I think we're trying to make predictions at a slice in time and extrapolate continuously forward.
But that does drive the policy decisions on some level.
But I mean, I think that throughout this whole thing, there's sort of a, if I talked to, about this 6 months ago and most people didn't know what agents did, they had a much different view of what AI, what jobs would be affected by AI.
Right.
Now, to the bigger question, I think that there is this belief, there is a nice push from David and from Darren Acemoglu, the Nobel Prize winner. They work together on this stuff about how AI might be create equality because you have traditionally lower paid workers can expand what they do in useful ways. That's going to be contested also, right? And every time there is, putting my sociologist hat, like there's fights over what the borders of different industries and jobs are. Doctors have a lot of political power. They may force it so that you have to use a doctor.
But see, that's one of my big questions. If indeed this plays out in a way where the people who are in the crosshairs are the people who right now have the economic and political power, will we see something different happen? And you mentioned, Martha, that the Weavers were not able to hold it off, even though they were in a relatively privileged place in society. Do you think that's a fair roadmap? So again, we're not assuming that that's what happens, but if the white collar workers are the ones that end up being in the bullseye of this, do you think they have essentially the clout to beat it back?
Historically, you can't stop technological progress. Yeah. You just can't. I do want to say, you know, on this question around, you know, policy response, I think it is really, really important, per Ethan's point, that we not do a policy response that assumes a certain path forward for this.
Be flexible.
You need to be flexible, right? Things like unemployment insurance can respond to disruptions of different size and different, you know, hitting in different places. Whereas if you go with UBI, for instance, leaving aside questions of cost and implementation.
Universal basic income, yeah.
Universal basic income, sorry. You know, that only makes sense in very specific versions of the world. I think the thing that's really important to keep in mind with the 19th century is part of what made it so difficult. There were a bunch of factors there. You really did not see a policy response. There is a famous line in A Christmas Carol where Scrooge says about helping poor people, are there no prisons? Are there no poorhouses? Mm. And I think it is really, really important. One, our social safety net has evolved past that, thank God. But we need to be thinking really carefully about where it needs to be shored up, because no matter what, in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to see disruption in the economy. And we need to make sure that we can handle that and we can help the people who are affected.
Assume you don't know the outcome instead of trying to plan for what you think the outcome will be.
Yeah, exactly.
So we do have to wrap up the conversation there. And I enjoyed it thoroughly, just so much. I mean, I could do 2-3 hours on this, if you couldn't tell, Ethan. But let me thank you, Ethan Mollick, Associate Professor and Co-Director of Generative AI Labs at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and also author of Co-Intelligence. Ethan, always great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Martha Gimbel, Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Budget Lab at Yale. So many great insights, Martha. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And let me read this final comment from Real Aquaman on YouTube, who says, AI will come for your job, but you have to put yourself in a position to be the one to own AI, not the other way around. I just started a business, and AI is my silent partner. Well, let me shout out some partners who made this show today. Our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Al Banks is our engineer. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.